Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Mmm, now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
We need to be able, we need lots of people saying Joe Biden is great. But it's okay to vote for Joe Biden and just think Joe Biden is okay.
Yeah.
And you are, if you think Joe Biden is okay, you are welcome in our campaign. If you disagree with Joe Biden, you are welcome in our campaign. Like, if you're having a conversation with your friend who's like, I can't possibly vote for Joe Biden, you go, I hear you. And I disagree on with him on X, Y, and Z point, but he's been really good on this issue I care about and this issue I care about and this issue I care about. And ultimately, this election is about whether or not we are moving our democracy forward and we are protecting our freedoms and our and all of that stuff. You know, people, that's believable and plausible.
Hey, everyone. It's Jon Favreau, and you just heard from today's guest, Rob Flaherty. I'm in D.C. this week, so I thought I'd sit down with one of the most extremely online people I know who also happens to have the job of making sure Donald Trump doesn't become president again. Rob ran digital strategy for the Biden campaign in 2020. Then he became the director of digital strategy at the White House after his boss won. And today, Rob is back on the campaign trail working as Biden's deputy campaign manager. I wanted to talk to Rob because, if you haven't noticed, quite a bit has changed since 2020 when it comes to communicating with voters. The media environment is more fractured. TikTok has evolved from a dance app to a national security threat. And Twitter, the platform that defined the Trump era, is, to put it charitably, no longer what it once was. A Biden versus Trump rematch may make it feel like we're reliving 2020, but when it comes to digital media, the election could not be any more different. I've been curious about how the Biden campaign is thinking about these seismic shifts, how they're attempting to reach voters, what messages they think will cut through the noise, why the campaign joined TikTok, and what their plan is to win the internet. Rob and I talked about all of that, plus why he thinks it's important to acknowledge voters' frustrations, why the campaign's spending more time trying to get volunteers to talk to their friends and family, and what he thinks of Donald Trump's digital strategy. Since I'm on the road, we're going to skip the news block this week and get straight to the interview. Here's Rob Flaherty. Rob Flaherty, welcome to Offline.
Thrilled to be here, John.
All right, I want to start with the most important headline about your current gig. This is from the Boston Globe. North Reading native Rob Flaherty to serve as deputy manager of Biden reelection campaign.
That's right.
You've made our little hometown proud.
Go Hornets, you know.
You also made me feel old since you graduated 10 years before me from our high school, which you know, just brutal.
Different generations. Although I remember very vividly walking back into the high school being like the kid who comes back, you know, whatever. And there's, you know, I had been in politics, you'd been in politics, and there was a giant picture of you and
really?
No picture of me.
I did not even know that. I don't know.
So you have quite a lead.
For people who don't know, about 100 people graduate from North Reading High every year, so it's not a big, not too big of a deal. So I do want to start there because I'd love to know how and why your area of expertise in politics became digital strategy and communications.
Yeah, it's funny. I got into it. Like, the embarrassing thing is, like, I got into it because I watched The West Wing, and I was like, I want to do that,
nice.
You know?
That's
like,
no harm
who,
in that.
He among us. Yeah. And now you say that, and it's embarrassing. But, but no, and then, you know, I wanted to be kind of a press person, but I went to school for television production and video editing and all that stuff.
Oh.
And so when I graduated, and I did all this, like, political stuff in college and thought that would, you know, get me a job pretty easily once I graduated, and it didn't. and so I took an internship on Terry McAuliffe's campaign, and they were like, does anyone here know how to edit videos? And I was like, well, I guess I do.
Okay.
And so I just started making hashtag content, and then I just kind of kept moving.
So you did digital for Hillary in 16, Beto in 20, Biden White House after that, and now the Biden reelect.
Yep.
How has the job changed over the years?
Well, I think like the biggest, I think the biggest shift from the 20 campaign to now is Ryan Broderick has Garbage Day, which is a, you know, a really great
love Garbage
newsletter.
Day.
Yeah, it's awesome. And he kind of talked about like the public internet and the private internet and the way that things are splitting between the places where people kind of consume discourse and the places where people talk to their friends. Mm. And I actually think that splintering is like really important. In 2022, I think it was, or no, last year, Adam Mosseri, who's the CEO of Instagram, said that half of the content that gets shared on Instagram happens in private.
Wow.
And so one of the biggest shifts, I think, has been that we actually, as people who do digital, need to actually be thinking about how do you get people to like share stuff in their group chats,
yeah,
and talk to their friends, and sort of rethinking. It's not enough just to like plaster content out there and like hope people will see it. You have to think about the distribution network too. And so that's it's that sort of linkage between this and organizing that I think is really the biggest change.
I want to get into that a little more. How do you like, how is the media environment changed? Obviously, there's the, as you mentioned, the split between like the public and private internet.
Yeah.
But there's also just been this like complete splintering of where people are getting their news from,
yeah,
how much they're paying attention to the news. And that has, I imagine, all kinds of effects on public opinion, on what people view. It's just like, it feels like the, usually people talk about shared reality like in the context of disinformation, but even disinformation aside, it's just people who are consuming information about politics right now just aren't in the same reality because there's so many different sources. Like, how did you guys think about that?
Well, I think because like everyone talks about fractured, balkanized media environment, but it's really that it's personalized, mm-hmm, right? And I actually think the biggest distinction is not just that people who are on the left and people on the right live in different realities. It's that people who follow politics and people who don't follow politics live, yeah, in very different realities. And
which is most people.
Which is most
who
people.
Who don't follow politics.
Right. And so, like, you know, for us, this presents a real challenge in a number of ways. One, if you look at this election, you know, the voters who show up all the time and really care about politics and are paying attention to traditional political media, we're winning a lot of those voters. It's why we're winning these specials. It's why we're winning these midterms. Trump has his sporadic voters who are going to show up. And the question is, what happens to our sporadic voters who are deciding between, you know, not Joe Biden and Donald Trump, but Joe Biden and the couch? And for a lot of those voters, I mean, and, you know, we clocked it maybe a month ago. About 40% of them did not think Donald Trump was going to be the Republican nominee.
Mm. Has that number changed at all?
It's gotten
smaller.
It's smaller as he gets more coverage. But the truth of the matter is these are voters who, like, have other things to do than pay attention to politics.
Yeah.
And for us, they are, you know, really a important constituency. And those voters are seeing tons of media. I mean, the average voter, we have it clocked at, consumes 12 and a half hours of content a day. And wow, that's not just...
And those are people who don't pay close attention to politics.
That's
just content.
Average everybody, just content and everybody. And that's overlapping, right? That's on being on your phone while you're on TV. Like, it's just like a lot. But it's just a bananas amount of stuff that they are seeing. And when a lot of it is not political or it's political on the margins, it's really hard to communicate. And so for us, it means you got to be in more places, both from a paid media perspective, which is just like you got to diversify how you think about paid media. You got to diversify how you think about earned media, right? The president does all these interviews with influencers and content creators and you know, engagements with them. And then also you need to think about how you get to people through who they ultimately trust the most, which is their friends and their family.
So talk to me about like the beginning of this campaign. You've got the media environment you just described. You've got a fairly grumpy electorate. You've got a president who has accomplished an enormous amount, is not getting credit for it, is getting blamed for things, many of which are largely beyond his control. What are the like initial strategy sessions like in terms of like, all right, this is how we're going to communicate and reach people, and this is how much we're going to think about making sure people know what Joe Biden has accomplished. This is how we're going to think about laying out the choice between he and Trump in terms of the content that you're putting out there?
Well, so a couple of things is we came in knowing that we don't actually, like, the playbook needs to change. And that there's plenty of stuff that we know works and will be part of the arsenal. But there's just some assumptions that we need to really pressure test. And so this is really the advantage we had of having a incumbency and having a campaign and having, by the way, a DNC that was, you know, the political arm for a while. We spent 4 years sort of refining and testing tactics. If you look at last year, we had this like $30 million ad buy that we started in like August. And these organizing pilots that were sort of sitting under, you know, them at the same time in Arizona and in Wisconsin. And the goal of that was to go like, what tactics are going to work? What messages are going to work? All of that stuff. And I think there's like a couple of things that we found, like trust is like the real variable here. Like with an electorate feeling the way that it does with, you know, the media environment that it is, like who people trust really matters. And so, you know, certainly we found, like, we tested different media mixes. We found, you know, the ways that people consumed information were really different and really surprising. And the places where they are, you know, we needed to be in different places. Messengers really mattered. Like, having the president in content so folks could see him more directly matters. Validators and testimonials really matter. People sharing their stories themselves. And I think that connects. Like, I think there's a through line between that, people responding to people talking about their experiences with the president's accomplishments and how it's made a difference in their lives. And the fact that also we believe that that is key to our organizing system, which is that, like, those, you know. And so that kind of ties in with the organizing pilots, which is, you know, we sort of believe that this community, like, people say relational, but it's really organizing your community in a very traditional sense, you know, that this kind of like relational community organizing stuff where people talk to their friends and their family, you know, the hit on it was, well, if your volunteer base is all well-educated.
Right. How are they going to reach out?
How are you actually going to reach? Because that's probably who all their friends are. And so this woman, Ruhi Rustam, who's our organizing director, came up with this system in these pilots to find organizers from those communities, recruit them at scale, and then have them recruit volunteers from the, you know, that they know. And so what we were able to develop through those pilots was a really good system of like getting hard to reach volunteers to reach hard to reach people through conversations and through content. There's still more we have to learn, but I think to your initial question, it's like when we think about the problem set that we walked into, we spent basically all of 2023 sort of refining, testing, experimenting with the idea that we don't have all the answers quite yet. But now we're starting to scale in states, and a lot of those learnings are, you know, going to be part of the core program as we move into the general.
Talk to me about the type of content that you create, because I imagine as you're trying to reach a cohort of voters who don't pay a lot of attention to political news, don't trust a lot of institutions or news, trust their friends and family, like, giving them traditional political content, a 30-second ad that you'd see in any campaign, or like a list of talking points that's like, Joe Biden did the CHIPS Act, you know, like, that's probably not going to resonate because these people have sort of like a finely honed bullshit detector.
Yep.
Like, what kind of content have you found really resonates with some of these harder to reach voters?
So it's a couple of things. It's funny because I said this on Podsafe, but it's like if you if I texted a graphic that said Bidenomics is working to my group chat, I would get hammered. You know, I would be removed. And like, I think one of the places where we had to evolve, which is like political campaign content makers are great at making very glossy content.
Yeah.
That feels, you know, great. It's like an ad. But like people actually, when they got in there, were like, well, I'm not going to share that.
Right.
And so, you know, there's like an aesthetic proposition, which is like we have to make it less aesthetic, whatever. But we've also found that like people like to share articles. They like to share, like, one of the things we've worked on training volunteers on is like how to, and this is complicated, I'm not good at it 100% of the time, how to share content without it seeming like propaganda.
Yeah.
And how to make it feel authentic. And that might be like sharing content might just be I posted on Facebook, or, you know, I put something in a group chat. You know, one example came from someone we were bouncing ideas off, was like, actually what you should be doing is sharing stuff to your friends and going, what do you think about this? As like a neutral observer versus and ask for their reaction. And then you can have that conversation. Because actually what you're trying to do online, like I think people conceive of this as like, oh, I share a graphic on my Facebook feed. But what we're actually trying to do is start a conversation in the same way that we would ask you for a relational conversation where it'd be like, oh, I'm going to go talk to John. It's the idea of, okay, great. Well, I've posted this thing and these people have reacted to it and now I can engage with them further. And so it's like, how do you use it as a starting point? So it's less a content equation and more a conversation equation.
What where are most of your like target voters getting their news from these days? I'm always so curious about like media diets and how they've changed.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. It's hard. It's hard because there's what they tell you and then there's like what is actually true, right? Mm-hmm. If you ask the question of where do you consume news, it's like, well, of course I watch CNN.
Yeah.
But then the ratings don't bear that out.
Right.
Sorry, CNN.
No, I've seen them.
you know, there's – what I think is true is that like what we've seen is that where people are getting information is pretty similar. Age is the biggest distinction, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's not race or any of this stuff. Like if you ask what – where you are physically getting it, you know, it's like it tends to be a little more TV for older audiences, less TV for younger audiences, more social media for younger audiences. And that's true across race, across gender. But once you get to those places, it's just insanely different. I think like a couple of things that are true for a lot of these voters is the role of local news still matters. And I think people in politics say that to the point of cliche, but it really is true. It's
wow.
It's a lot of people watch local news.
That's television because obviously
local television.
Yeah.
The thing people sleep on is Google search. We did some research on where do you go when news breaks, and like search was right up there. People are going there, which is, by the way, a big – like campaigns don't invest in SEO in the same way that they ought to or search advertising, which, you know, is certainly a thing that we're, you know, paying a lot of attention to. So, you know, it's those sort of surfaces. But I also think that like – and it's sort of like the TikTokification of everything is that like people are getting news and information from just – people, you know,
this is back to the like the text chains, group threads. People are just that's how they're getting.
Yeah, and like you know, there are people giving their commentary, like you know, like a 25-year-old or 21-year-old college kid is giving their commentary on the news and getting millions of views, and like that's where people are hearing about it. So there's just like it's hard. The problem is I can't say where are people getting their news because it's super personalized now.
I mean, the challenge seems like. So just listening to it, it's like gives me a headache because it feels like you almost have to relinquish some control here over the entire communications apparatus because the idea that you're going to like blast out a message and it's going to get to everyone is just like that's been long dead.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely right. And like we think about sometimes the messages we put out from our accounts, the president's accounts. I always think it's better to think of them as like a distributed talking points. People are looking at us to go, what are they doing? And then they're riffing. And that's great. And like one of the things that I think we're working through is like, what do we use? Like Trump is really good at this, which is like using his social accounts to encourage further content generation, you know? Like that kind of thing. There is you have to kind of let people talk about it in ways that feel real and authentic to them, but give people a sense of like a clear theme, and then they can iterate off of it.
On ads, since there's so many people like cutting the cord, obviously you're still going to spend a lot on linear television, spend a lot of ads on there.
Yep.
But a lot of people are going to platforms or streaming services. A lot of them like don't allow political ads.
Yep.
How are you guys handling that?
Yeah, well, it's... You know, first, that a lot of them don't allow political ads, and a lot of them don't like a lot of the big ones don't have ads at all, or barely have ad supported. And so, you know, I think that is like one of the challenges, which is like I don't think we can actually write off linear television as a surface, but you have to just think about where people are when they're watching linear television, right? Like, if you look at the top 100 broadcasts on TV, I think like 99 of them last year were sports games, with like 90 of them being the NFL or some like crazy number like that, like. It, you know, I think we are seeing that you kind of want to shift to not the long tail, the short end of the tail, where there's like higher audience on TV. And then, yeah, like there's just limited, more limited places when you get to streaming. That being said, I think we write off social as a persuasion surface for advertising in like a in a real way. And I think a lot of times, you know, people go, well, it's just, you know, it's good for fundraising or direct response and all that stuff. But actually, you know, there is plenty of empirical evidence that social media changes minds.
Do you think ads are still as effective as they were? I always wonder this from, again, like an authenticity perspective. Like if someone hears from a friend or sees a piece of content just floating around that is somewhat persuasive on why they should vote for Joe Biden, like that would be more effective than, oh, I know this is coming. This is an ad coming from the Biden campaign.
I think that there's real truth to that, which is I think people's bullshitometer is just higher.
Yeah.
But it's not to say ads don't matter. I think I actually don't think that that's true. What I do think is true is – like no one's ever going to tell you they were persuaded by an ad.
You know? That is, yes.
But you do start to hear that stuff. Like one of the best indicators of, and you know this, of is an ad setting in is do you start to hear about it on the doors, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not because people are like, well, I saw this ad that says this. It's just because the thing has sort of sunk in. I think it's, the reality is it's a whole system and the ads matter as part of a system, but they have to be reflective of what people are also talking about with their friends.
Right.
And so like this is the new thing, which is like, how do we think about messaging through our supporters to their friends in ways that is part of the same system as the advertising that we are putting in front of them, as the content that we are putting out, so that there is it's, you know, there's sort of an air game and a ground game on the way that we are messaging, and not just on, you know, there's a field system for GOTV and an ad system for communications and earned media in between.
Hey, Fidelity. How can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Mmm, now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
The most valuable resource on a campaign is the president's time.
Yep.
How do you guys think about using his time in terms of reaching out to voters, communicating, doing interviews, producing content, all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think you have to step back on goals. So like a great example is we went to North Carolina, it was a couple months ago, and what we had Biden do is go sit down at a family's kitchen table and do like an hour-long discussion with this father and his two sons. And it was closed press. It was just for us. And, you know, we initially conceived of it as, oh, we'll get some content. It'll be like a great, you know, digital moment. But actually, first he walked in and there was a big pool spray, which, you know, all these reporters taking photos, whatever. And then he goes in. We work with the kid to make a TikTok of the experience. The kid puts the TikTok out, gets 5 million views, leaves, All the reporters come, the family gaggles, and what we got was amazing local news coverage. And then this video from the kid got like 5 million views. It got picked up by Barstool and Complex and The Shade Room and all these places. And if you look at the goal of – you have to like step back to what your goal is. If your goal is to drive local coverage with a rally – we just did that,
yeah.
You know, with this format that actually plays to the president's strength because he can talk to people in a way that Donald Trump could never dream of. And so, you know, what it means is like, I think given the environment has changed so much, we have to like rethink like, what are we actually trying to achieve? You know, like a big rally with lots of cameras that generates local news coverage. Great. We also did that with this, but that rally, like a rally also generates data for the field program. So that's a huge, you know, like there's just different stuff. So we really have to rethink the president's time. I think the other thing is in the environment that we live in, like there's no true broadcasts anymore. You can only like go around collecting narrowcasts.
Yeah.
And so you'll see the president and vice president do, you know, these engagements with creators who might have, you know, I don't know, like the vice president went on a couple of like more niche podcasts, but that audience is an audience we really need.
Mm.
And so, you know, I think like as you're seeing, you know, there's all this sort of gripes about, oh, well, the president's not sitting down with traditional media, but those traditional media outlets all talk to the same people.
I was going to say, are you saying sitting down with a bunch of New York Times reporters so that the president can just have a couple quotes in a story that's framed by someone else, that's not the most valuable use
might
of his
not
time.
Be the way to reach voters today.
We're sitting here is this whole White House New York Times controversy,
yes.
Stupid controversy has yes. erupted. But my initial thought on that was like, it's not about how the Times covers the president. It's not about the president. I want to get questions. It actually is about the fact that the New York Times, while still the biggest, you know, media outlet in the country and still quite influential, is no longer as influential as it once was, not for any fault of the Times itself, but just because, like, of everything that we've been talking about so far. Like, there's so many other ways that people are getting their news. And if you're using the president's time, you have to think to yourself, okay, how many people reading the New York Times are already Biden voters?
That's right.
Right? And, like, what good is that going to get you guys from a campaign perspective?
Totally. And I'm not here to denigrate the New York Times. I am myself a subscriber.
I'm a subscriber. No, I love it. Yeah.
But the problem is that we're subscribers.
That's what I'm saying. Right.
And we're good. We're voting. And we're voting for Joe Biden, I think.
I'm in.
You're like, you know, Bobby Curious. you know, so it's that we have to be really intentional about the voters that we need. And the voters right now that we need to figure out how to talk to, it is probably rare that they are going to the New York Times. And so we need to go to where they are. And so that's how we think about it with how we use the president.
Everyone made a big deal about the Biden not sitting down for the Super Bowl thing. Was that because you guys thought that maybe – I saw you guys say that, like, well, if he does that, you know, people are just trying to watch a game and they're going to ask him all these tough questions.
Yep.
Did you think that he wouldn't get a bunch of questions that would fit with the mood of people watching, like, a sporting event? Or what was like, the thinking there?
I think you just have to think about the context of where people were. I mean, it's just like – you know, I was at a Super Bowl party. The last thing I want to do is like talk about like, you know, X, Y, and Z contentious issue.
Or like introduce to people for the first time, special counsel Robert Hur question.
Yeah, it's not where people like there's a potential of like there are times where talking about politics can really turn people off.
Yeah.
and you hear that, you know, you hear that particularly around a lot of sports games, like leave the politics out of it. So, you know, I just think that there are other places and other times where we're able to have that discussion. And the president has had that discussion day in and day out with reporters asking him questions all the time. So it just, you know.
Is that a larger challenge? There's people getting sick, like tired and exhausted by politics after all of us having to like live in this fucking Trump purgatory for 8 years.
I think it's true.
Like, are you guys noticing that? I feel like we notice it too, even. And like, it's just yeah. like there's a core of junkies like us who are paying attention.
Yeah.
But the universe of people who I feel like in 16 and even 20 were like active and engaged. Even that, there's some fraying there, and people are like, I'm just tired.
I think it's true. I think, look, I've been working on stopping Donald Trump now for like 10 years. You know what I mean?
Have we all? Lives, it might have been. Yeah, I don't know.
Like, I think people are certainly experienced in this fight. But I'll say, like, every election is different. This election is like a different, you know, there's just a lot of pent up anti-Trump energy in 20. In this one, there's like a couple things that are different. One, Trump is less visible. The media has covered him less. He's not on Twitter doing his thing. Two, like, you know, Trump is, it's just a darker, he's darker, you mm-hmm. know, the version of the country he is presenting is darker. But I think what you're going to see is this is an election where people are going to tune in late. And that is true of the voters who are not paying attention. It's just true of folks who are like, all right, I got to get my energy back up to fight this. But, you know, I think there are, we're starting from a good foundation. One of the things in my job that lives outside of like highfalutin thought about media environments is like, I also am over the grassroots fundraising
right.
program. You know, if you look at Joe Biden's donors, we have 1.6 million grassroots donors, 40% of them are new.
I was pretty amazed by that stat.
And so, you know, what that tells me is like, there is that energy that is sitting there. And it's just a matter of like people starting to clock in. And I think that'll happen as Trump gets more coverage. I think that'll happen as we start to get closer and the stakes get higher. And so, you know, that stuff is all part of it. But there's definitely a, you know, I think all folks are recognizing like, okay, we got to do this again. And that's definitely a factor.
I know someone on your campaign told the New Yorker for that Evan Osnos piece that they thought polling was broken. Like, you and I could talk forever about like the problems with public polling.
Yeah.
We could just do a whole episode on that. But like internally, do you guys feel good that you have a approximate sense of where the electorate is in the key swing states?
Yeah, I think we do. And like, breaking news, it's going to be a really close election. I'm not here to say it's going to be anything but close. Last time we only won by 45,000 votes.
I know. That's what I keep saying. Like, even if you put all the argument about the polling, if you put all the polling aside,
yeah,
you would, and you couldn't see it.
Yeah.
You would just say, like 16 was close, 20 was close, and now 24 is literally a rematch between the two people who ran in 20.
Yeah, it's just going to be close. And there's like a couple of things about that, which is like, one, if you look at it structurally, you know, from the issues that we are running on that are popular, from the fact that our core challenge is winning back voters who already voted for us and not even winning back, just persuading them to participate.
Yeah.
Where Trump has to expand the amount of voters who voted for him, which he has shown no real interest in doing.
Yeah.
You know, I would rather be holding our cards than theirs. But that doesn't mean I'm sitting here saying this is going to be anything but hard. Mm. It is going to be a tough election. It is going to be close. But 45,000 votes is the margin of execution.
Yeah.
And that is the margin of a really good campaign with really great supporters doing really good work and showing up and volunteering and making calls and donating and doing all that stuff. Like, I find the closeness of the election to actually be really empowering because you can do something. If you don't think you can move as a person 10 votes, 15 votes, you can do it. And then you multiply that, we can do that.
What you've talked about this a couple times, like empowering the volunteers and the organizers to like go be messengers.
Yeah.
Like Pfeiffer always talks about this too. What's like getting into the details, how do you do that? Like, if someone comes to the campaign and is like, I'm a volunteer, I live in Michigan, I want to go do my thing, like, what do you arm those people with?
So one of the things that came out of those pilots was the idea that different volunteers want to volunteer in different ways, right? So there are plenty of volunteers who are like, I don't want to talk to a single friend of mine. You know what I want to do? I want to go knock some doors.
Okay.
And I want to make some calls.
Uh-huh.
And there were plenty of people who were like, I don't want to knock a single door and talk to a single stranger. I will talk to my friend. And there was one lady who just like literally did 300 relational contacts like in 2 weeks in Arizona, who is like one of the great heroes of the early stages of this campaign.
That is.
You know, and so, like, one of the foundational principles for our our program is this idea. It's, you know, kind of like come as you are, right? Like if you want to do something, we want to give you the tools to do that thing, and it will be impactful and it will matter. You know, in the context of talking to your friends, you know, one of the things, Reach is sort of our app of choice. And, you know, basically what you do is you sign up and it you know, you can match your contacts. It'll tell you who, you know that we need you to talk to, that kind of thing. But it'll also provide you with galleries of content, that either as starting points and all that stuff. You know, there's some stuff that we are like, there's some stuff we're going to evolve. Like one of the things that's true about the way we're setting up our states programs is they're run by really experienced people who have won those states before, and they're given real latitude to do what they need to do to win those states. And so different states are going to try different things and different ways of getting people to share content and getting them to talk to their friends. For example, like if we're writing off WhatsApp, which is a just absolutely massive platform for Latinos, or really anyone who has, you know, large immigrant communities, AAPI, you know, particularly South Asians, we're not talking to people. So like different states are going to have to play around with that. So Reach is sort of the core foundation, but there's going to be, you know, a lot of variants of how we apply it when we get to different states.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Hey, Fidelity. How can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Huge difference between 20 and 24 is like Twitter, not what it once was.
Yeah.
Facebook's no longer pushing news.
Yep.
TikTok is now in limbo.
Yeah.
How do you think about like the different social media platforms now? Like is Twitter, I assume Twitter is sort of what you were saying before, mainly a platform to kind of communicate with journalists, people who are shaping public opinion, sort of like elites who are going to go out there and shape public opinion. Is that mainly how you guys see Twitter now?
Yeah. I think it's helpful to like think about it as the place for high attention people. Mm. And, you know, I think it has certainly diminished as a surface for that. But as long as reporters are still there, you know, and as long as people are still using it, you know, we are going to engage there. You know, I think the biggest difference is the uncertainty around organic content, like across the board, right? Like it used to be Twitter was the place where there were two advantages to it. One, elites were on it, but two, it was the place where you kind of break into culture. Like, you know, a good tweet can move to different audiences there, and then it becomes like a whole thing. And we've had a couple of those. Increasingly, though, like Instagram can be a surface for that, and like TikTok really is that. And I think it's important, like the public and private internet construction we talked about earlier, I think is sort of an indicator on this, which is like Twitter's a behavior at the end of the day. Like what goes on Twitter is there are people who want to talk about politics, and there's people who want to watch people talk about politics, and they want to and that idea that people are watching the discourse happen and that discourse is happening in certain places, there's different platforms where that is going to live. But the places where people talk to their friends, that is like, that is shifting. And like, we need a strategy to deal with that. So it's, you know, sort of a two-prong.
Obviously, the president signed the TikTok, the legislation that forces ByteDance to divest TikTok within a certain amount of days until January, you could probably go to. You guys are still on it in the campaign for obvious reasons. It's still there. You're going to be on it. Are there any like privacy concerns that you guys have in the campaign, or like do you just have like a burner phone?
Literally, yeah.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, you know, we're not taking any risks on this, and certainly we go in clear eyed about the platform risks that come with TikTok. You know, we have no bearing on what the government does with it. You know, we have to take those precautions. And, you know, at the end of the day, as long as it's a place where people are getting information about the president, it's a place where we need to be inserting our side.
Yeah. Have you guys gotten blowback from like TikTok influencers that you're working with because of the ban, because of the legislation?
It varies. We hear from folks on both sides of it, honestly. Yeah. You know, we hear from folks who are like, yeah, this is a little sus. You know, we hear from folks who are like, this is going to be hard for me. You know, we do that outreach. The official side does a lot of that outreach too. You know, the Office of Digital Strategy and everything Christian's doing over there. So, but you know, I folks have different opinions on this, and you know, we're going to continue
keep moving ahead.
Yep.
I've heard you talk about the importance of communicating in a way that meets people where they are, right? Yep. So like acknowledging that, you know, whatever frustrations they may have, anger, making sure people they know that they like they don't have to agree with everything that Joe Biden believes in or has done to vote for him. That is like that is the kind of nuanced, thoughtful approach that is what politics is all about, right? Yep. That's what door-to-door organizing is all about. It doesn't really fit well online.
Yeah.
How totally. Do you translate that to the work that you do?
Well, but like, here's my thing is like,
because this is my like perpetual frustration with politics.
Yeah, I know 100%.
Like why I started this show.
This entire thing.
Yeah.
Like to me, I thought AOC gave a really eloquent answer along these lines, which was even if you are, and this is assuming, you know, you're someone with sort of a lefty political valence, right. You know, if you're someone who is mad at the president for X, Y, and Z reasons or has X, Y, and Z policy disagreements with him and you're coming at him from the left, you know, what conditions do you want to organize under, you know, and what conditions do you want to be doing your work under to advance your agenda? Do you want someone who's going to be open to it or do you want someone who's going to be totally closed to it? I think that is a really compelling argument. My thing is like, we need lots of people saying Joe Biden is great. But it's okay to vote for Joe Biden and just think Joe Biden is okay.
Yeah.
And if you think Joe Biden is okay, you are welcome in our campaign. If you disagree with Joe Biden, you are welcome in our campaign. Joe Biden will be the first one to say this. He's a president for all Americans. You know, I think that like at the end of the day, folks making the argument that I disagree with Joe Biden on X, Y, and Z, or I would have liked to have seen him do this thing, but I'm going to vote for him because it's really important. That's fine. That's part of the tent.
Yeah.
And candidly, there's some evidence we've seen in testing that that is a really good way in. Like if you're having a conversation with your friend who's like, I can't possibly vote for Joe Biden, you go, I hear you. And I disagree with him on X, Y, and Z point, but he's been really good on this issue I care about and this issue I care about and this issue I care about. And ultimately, this election is about whether or not we are moving our democracy forward and we are protecting our freedoms and all of that stuff. You know, people, that's believable and plausible.
Yeah.
You know,
it's interesting you mentioned that about AOC because we at Cricut, I'll notice that when we post clips that are favorable of Joe Biden.
Yeah.
I notice this on all platforms everywhere now, and I'm sure you guys see this. It gets flooded with a lot of conversation about Gaza because people feel very strongly, and you know we've talked about it a lot on our pods too. But when I interviewed Bernie on Pod Save America, and Bernie both, like, in one clip criticized Biden on Gaza, but then gave the answer similar to AOC, which is like, this is why it's so important to elect Joe Biden.
Yeah.
The comments on that were like more favorable towards Biden and Bernie that I had seen.
Yeah.
So I do wonder if there is like, are you guys trying to create permission structures, not just with young people, but with like all kinds of different groups that are sort of at the edge of the coalition that elected Biden?
This part of the campaign is the age of permission structures. That is what this is. There are tons of, and I actually, one of the things that has been a gripe for me about the campaign is there are tons of enthusiastic Joe Biden supporters. They are just not very loud on the internet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we see that in the fact that we have this big grassroots fundraising machine that has proven to be really effective and really stable. There are a lot of voters who just love Joe Biden and they're here for Joe Biden. Our coalition needs some people who are like, and that's okay. And that's right. Is how do we create the permission structure for them to go, all right, you know, I'm voting for him, even if I don't agree with him on literally every single thing, which you're never going to agree with every politician on every single thing. And this goes back. I mean, it's a very Biden-y ethos, which is like, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really, at the core of it.
What do you think about the Trump campaign's digital strategy? Anything that impresses you or keeps you up at night?
I think that the Trump team is the stuff you've talked about letting encouraging an ecosystem that will amplify them. They are really good at it. Mm-hmm. Look, we'd be dumb if we weren't watching them. There's some stuff that they do where I'm like, I don't know about that. And I have always sort of thought that the 2016 Ooga Booga about their digital ad strategy was like a little overwrought. Mm. But they're smart. It's a more disciplined version of Trump, certainly. More disciplined version of the Trump campaign. Not necessarily Trump. Yeah. I think that there's some stuff over there that they're doing that's, you know, sharp and it's going to be tight.
Why do you think he hasn't come back on Twitter?
I don't know, and I don't want to speculate, but I maybe it is, you know, trying to. I mean, I'm like, I don't want to speculate. No, I'm speculating. But
I mean, there are thoughts that it's like a financial.
That's my bet.
Yeah, there's thoughts that, I mean, the reason I ask is there's a larger challenge where, and you mentioned this before, that like people have not seen as much Trump.
Yeah.
Since he's been off Twitter and he's been sort of out of, and now they're seeing more of him, especially with the trial going on.
Yeah.
And I always wonder if that's like a concerted stretch, or if like there's the campaign, which is a little bit more disciplined, is actually saying to themselves, a little less Trump would be better, knowing that they have a guy who's not going to be able to keep him out of the limelight. But I was sort of wondering if they're purposely trying to sort of like cordon him off a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that the more people hear about Donald Trump and the more people see Donald Trump, the more they are reminded. Mm. And that's not, there are times where, you know, he says something that's funny or goofy and like the non-political world goes, oh, ha ha ha, that's funny. But, you know, at the end of the day, his recession in voters' minds is an advantage to him. Mm. And so, you know, we have to do the work of drawing attention to him and making sure reporters are seeing it and covering it, making sure that voters are seeing it in their feeds. That's why this like Biden HQ strategy is like one that we adopted pretty early was because, you know, there needs to be more Donald Trump in people's periphery.
Yeah.
So the stakes are raised in their eyes.
Last question. How do you, like, what is your media diet? How do you keep up with?
Yeah.
Are you just like, are you guys have like a campaign email where you're getting clips all day? Or are you just like mainlining Twitter? Like, what are you doing?
You know, what's funny. Well, so it's like a couple of things. One, I'm still on Twitter a good bit, though. Not as much as I used to be. I do occasionally dabble in TikTok myself, I would say. You know, it's like funny for me. I never watch cable. Like, I don't know what's going on cable on a given day. But yeah, I think it's like a mix of like Twitter, you know, TikTok. And then what's funny too is, you know, we're used to Clips email distributions, but we actually do it via a giant text chain now.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's like, which is like a new way of doing it. So
it'll be easier than just getting like random individual stories.
Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of the nice thing about working in the business is there's a fire hose in my phone of what the heck is going on in a given day.
Can't turn it off. Rob Flaherty, thank you so much for joining Offline. Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, John. Go Hornets.
Before we go, some quick housekeeping. Pod Save America is hitting the road this summer. The Democracy or Else tour all begins in Brooklyn on June 26th, followed by Boston on June 28th. Then we'll head to Madison, Phoenix, Ann Arbor, and Philly. See all the tour dates and get your tickets now at crooked.com/events. Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau, along with Max Fisher. It's produced by Austin Fisher. Emma Illick-Frank is our associate producer, mixed and edited by Jordan Cantor, audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Ari Schwartz, Madeline Herringer, and Reed Cherlin for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Delon Villanueva, who film and share our episodes as videos every week. Decoder, a podcast from The Verge about big ideas and other problems, is now publishing every Monday and Thursday. On Mondays, they bring their classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers about how they're navigating an ever-changing landscape, what keeps them up at night, and what it all means for our shared future. And now, on Thursdays, you'll hear shorter episodes explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show. Decoder with Nilay Patel. Go check it out wherever you get your podcasts.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday, and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion, and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling, and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.